Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Chris Braddock. My registration number is 23115. Thank you. Your Honor, we're asking the court dismiss this case for the prosecutor's pattern of misconduct and misrepresentation. Specifically, what we had in this matter was we had a release of several photos, or actually two general categories of photos. The first general category was a photo of a loving embrace that was taken with my client and the complaining witness. They were in a legal relationship. This relationship turned sexual. They were, in essence, living with each other at the complaining witness's house. The first photos were taken in December of 2009. The second photos were more of a gift. These were lingerie photos that the complaining witness took herself in the confines and the privacy of her home bedroom. And she took herself, she cropped them down, printed them out on a black and white printer, and then present them to the defendant as a gift. Your Honor, throughout the case, throughout the whole history of this case, what we have here is we have first that there was no disclosure initially of any of these black and white prints. What we had the first time that we saw this was at the preliminary hearing in May of 2010, I believe, where they turned around and they basically, on testimony from the detective Fellhaber, he basically testified that, oh, these prints were, or these photos were just, they were enhanced, they were modified, they were manipulated simply by lighting, by changing the lighting on these pictures. What we had disclosed initially to us was one set of color photos and another set of enhanced color photos. Now, we had no idea, there was no disclosure in any way, shape, or form regarding what was going on and how they were enhancing and modifying these photos.
Mr. Braddock, if I can interrupt you.
Yes.
Can you tell me what difference all this makes? Your client was acquitted of the counts involving the photos, and you never really say, you say things like the photos were enhanced, but you never tell us what difference it makes. But mainly, I mean, I get the mistrial argument may make a difference because you're arguing they provoked the mistrial. That's one thing. Your second argument says the court erred in not, you know, dismissing the case essentially as a sanction. But I can't see what difference it makes.
Well, Your Honor, I guess what difference this makes is that we only are supposed to be tried by one jury. At this point in time, we filed a motion in July requesting all photos, all evidence. Now, we didn't have to do that. That was required by law, required by Rule 16. Yet we went ahead and filed that. We filed that in July, yet no black and white photos, no photos in any way, shape, or form. In addition, what we had is additional conduct by the prosecutor in preventing and hiding how they manipulated these photos. We filed a successive series of motions regarding that specifically. Even on September 23rd, the court came down and actually ordered that the criminalist interview with defense counsel to find out exactly what happened. He didn't do that. He had to be ordered again on November 4th to finally interview with us, and at this time the district court put a deadline on it. At that point in time, we figured out the correct grounds to file a motion to prevent these manipulated photos from coming in.
Which the court granted.
But at that point in time, the jury had already been sat. This was an intentional behavior by the prosecutor because he knew he had to use manipulated photos to get a conviction in this case. And how do I know he knew that? Because when he used the black and white photos in the second case, he didn't get that conviction. But also, what he tried to do at the second trial was introduce additionally manipulated black and white photos at the beginning of the second trial that had never previously been disclosed to us, that had never been spoken to us until he surprised us at trial. And the court correctly said, we're not going to allow that in. But that shows his conduct and the conduct and his intention in trying to save his day. Now,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but let me back you up on that. I get it. I mean, I have some concerns about the prosecutor's conduct. I do. But now we're on the first argument again.
Yes.
What is the, I mean, I get your view is that this was intentional. What is the evidence? Are you asking us to infer that this was an effort to provoke a mistrial?
Yes.
Or is there anything more?
It's
just this intentional conduct.
No, I'm not asking you to infer. I think you can find it. This was an intentional mistrial provocation. What we had here, back on October 18th, we had a meeting with the prosecutor and the detective and the complaining witness in this case. At that time, the complaining witness said, in no uncertain terms, I only provided black and white prints to my client. Now, that is the corpus of this case, all the exploitation charges, what she had. She said, unequivocally, I only provided black and white prints, and I believe that has been provided to you on Rule 21, and it's throughout the record. Then what we had is a failure to provide those black and white prints in any way, shape, or form. We have this complete strategy of an intentional misrepresentation and trying to advance these manipulated photos.
Counsel, don't we have to start with the point where the trial court found that it was not intentional, and isn't that an abuse of discretion standard? And how would we overcome that at this point?
Well, I think the standard basically is clearly erroneous. You have to find that the district court's decision that it was in granting manifest necessity was clearly erroneous, and I think it probably was. And I think you can find that, one, by looking at the record and looking at the prosecutor's complete conduct. Now, we're not going to have a prosecutor stand up and say, oh yeah, I did this, this is my strategy. But you can infer what he's trying to do when you look at the whole history of the case. And I think it's telling in this case that what we had here, we had the complaining witness on October 18th state unequivocally this is a black and white print. All right. Then we had on December 12th, when we had the motions hearing regarding whether or not to let in these manipulated photos, she gets on the stand and she changes her testimony. She turns around and says, no, it was a color photo I provided to him. And when I spoke to Detective Fellhaber, he was wrong. Now, the prosecutor, in order to save his client, in order to save this complaining witness and her credibility, he had to come up and offer a stipulation, which is what he did on December 13th. At that point in time, he offered the stipulation and said, no, only black and white prints were presented.
Well, as you said, the prosecutor did not come up and say, I did it intentionally. And the trial court specifically found that it was not intentional. So at this point, aren't you just asking us to substitute our judgment for the judgment of the trial court?
Not at all. I think what we have here is, in the beginning, the district court made this decision shortly after the mistrial was granted. What we have then is we have a continuing behavior, and I think there's no more telling behavior than what we have at the second trial. And again, he continues with his pattern of misconduct, in trying to admit these modified, manipulated black and white prints now. And so now we have, he's going on the same course of conduct that he has always been. And so now we've got justification of what he's trying to do. He needs these manipulated photos to be able to prove that there was some type of artifact there that proved exploitation, and he was hell-bent on doing it. And so I think right now, based upon just that fact alone, as well as the whole history of this case, you can find that, well, that was a fact that the district court didn't have, but now looking back on it, we can see this was clearly erroneous.
So to follow up on Judge Ramon's question, Mr. Braddock, the standard is essentially clearly erroneous, and you acknowledge that we have to find the trial court's factual determination was clearly erroneous.
That's correct.
But yet the record seems to indicate that the prosecutor argued vigorously against a mistrial. He asserted that this was not new evidence, rather instead it had been provided, albeit in the form of color photographs as opposed to black and white. Now the prosecutor's statements are not undercut by any evidence in the record, are they? That he did not want a mistrial? Did he somehow fabricate that? Is there any finding by the trial court that we can rely on to say that he was false, he was being disingenuous?
Your Honor, I believe the prosecutor in effect was being disingenuous in this case. And I think you can find that by looking at the facts of the case, by knowing the fact that his complaining witness right now had just impeached herself on the very day of trial shortly after we had sat.
Well, is there any indication that she was coached? Is there any indication that she intentionally misrecalled what had happened, that she was told to say they were color photos that were given to your client or not?
Well, I think we're never going to have that evidence, and I think if by proffering that, you're raising the bar substantially higher than it is.
Well, I'm just trying to find evidence that would support your contention.
What we have here, and the evidence to support my contention is the fact that, one, she unequivocally states on one date, on October 18th, that black and white prints were presented only to the defendant. On the next date, on December 13th, she turns around and she says, no, it was color. And now on the cross-examination, she maintained it. She stated emphatically, no, I presented him color photos. Now we have an impeachment of evidence. For the prosecutor to save his credibility, and that's really what this case was all boiled down to, was the credibility of his complaining witness. For the prosecutor to save the credibility of his complaining witness, he needed to come in that next day and stipulate that only black and white prints were given. Now, we did not have a hearing. The judge did not require a hearing from that complaining witness as to how she figured out that only black and white prints were given, what type of conversations occurred, or any of the background that you're asking questions about. But what it was a stipulation. And then we have what I believe is a disingenuous argument by the prosecutor saying, no, I don't want a mistrial. I don't want a mistrial. Your Honor, whether or not the prosecutor wants a mistrial is not the standard. It's whether he provoked me into requesting a mistrial. And in this case, I was in a position where I had to look at evidence that I had never before seen or considered, or I had to proceed with the jury that I had chosen. Now, I'll argue to you that if I proceed to trial with evidence that I have never before seen or considered, that's ineffective, especially on a case where we have a black and white print that is the corpus, that is a whole body of the exploitation.
What's the difference? What was the prejudice to you? You know, what was the difference between the black and white and the color photo in your mind?
Well, at preliminary hearing, in the color photo, the detective testified to that he could actually see vaginal lips through the photos. Now, these were created artifacts. When we look at the black and white photos, all we see are lingerie pictures. When we looked at what they did and how they manipulated these photos, we found out that they used three separate programs on many different times. They boosted their intensity, or not their intensity, they boosted it from 96 dots per inch to 300 dots per inch. So these they modified the picture, and in so doing, they created artifacts that were not present. They advanced this type of evidence to try and say this was the real evidence that was given to my client, because that is the heart of this criminal charge, what he was given. So in effect, they fabricated evidence to try and convict my client, and they continued this even up through the second trial. Okay. I think what I'd like to do now is reserve. I see I have only 3 minutes left. I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Jones. My registration number is 31044, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. I will go ahead and limit my argument to the issues involving the photographs in this case, but of course, if the court has questions on the other issues on appeal, I'm happy to answer those as well. Now, the trial court properly denied the defendant's motion to dismiss based on double jeopardy grounds. Because the defendant moved for a mistrial, he waived any double jeopardy protections, and there is absolutely no support in the record for his claim that the prosecution intended to provoke his motion for a mistrial. There must be some evidence that the prosecutor was attempting to save his case by triggering a mistrial. The motivation of the prosecutor is the critical factor in this analysis. So whether or not the mistrial was provoked in order to gain a more favorable opportunity to convict is what this court must look at.
Well, and Ms. Jones, how would a defense counsel in Mr. Roddick's shoes prove that? I mean, don't you generally have to rely on circumstantial evidence? And I guess in line with that, I'd appreciate your addressing, and I know you weren't the lawyer below, but what was going on here? I mean, it just seems very odd when you're looking at a cold record. First, we got this issue about color versus black and white. Then you get to trial two, and they produce lighter black and white colors. I mean, I can understand the frustration from defense counsel. Now, maybe you there's nothing in the record, you couldn't answer that, but understand where we're sitting. That's very troubling. And so with that kind of background and these fairly concerning facts, what else is Mr. Braddock supposed to do?
Well, there certainly was some confusion initially about the photographs that were provided to the defendant. Now, the victim in this case had taken the photographs with her camera. She had uploaded those photographs to her computer. Then she had printed out those photographs at home and given copies of those photographs to the defendant. When the police took copies of those photographs from the computer, they appeared in color. And it wasn't clear initially how the victim had printed out those photographs and delivered them to the defendant. Now, there was testimony as early as October, which was 2 months before the trial in this case, where the victim said that she gave the defendant black and white photographs. Now, on the morning of trial, after the jury had been sworn in, the court did hold a hearing, and the victim said at that time that she had provided color photographs. The next morning, the prosecutor came in and said that the victim had gone home that night. She had looked at her printer again, realized that there was not a color cartridge in her printer, and that she had in fact only provided black and white photographs to the defendant. And the prosecution disclosed that to the court. The court at that point asked the prosecution to provide defense counsel with black and white copies of these photographs. which the prosecutor obtained by taking the photographs off the CD that had previously been provided to defense counsel and simply printing them out in black and white as opposed to color. So these photographs were available to defense counsel long before trial. There was evidence at least 2 months before trial that the photographs were provided to the defendant in black and white, and defense counsel certainly had the opportunity, just as the prosecution had, to print those photographs out at that time in black and white so that it could see what was actually provided to the defendant.
If I can just add, make sure I understand the facts here. So from October to the time when the victim first testifies, oh, they were color, everybody was thinking they're in black and white.
Yes.
So why was the prosecution then coming forward with color? I guess they're on their witness or exhibit list. If we all knew at least for 2 months they're black and white, why are we proffering color photos that have been enhanced to some extent?
And of course, Your Honor, I can't speak to the prosecution's motivation as far as why it was attempting to introduce color photographs at that time. But what I can speak to is the defendant's claim regarding the double jeopardy violation and how that plays into this court's analysis of that claim. In looking at the double jeopardy claim, there are certain factors that this court has to consider. And I think first and foremost, the court can look to the fact that the trial court found there was no prosecutorial misconduct here. And to the extent that there was a discovery violation at all, the court specifically found that that was not brought on by any action or inaction on the part of the prosecution. Further, the court found that the enhanced color photographs were not going to be admissible at trial. And at this point, no evidence had even been presented to the jury. So the jury was not aware that these color enhanced photographs even existed. The presentation of evidence had not even begun. So none of this occurred in front of the jury. And again, the prosecution objected to the motion for mistrial, which in the Baca case was a relevant factor that the court considered. And ultimately, all of this evidence was provided to the defendant.
Ms. Jones, sorry to interrupt. What Mr. Braddock said was that, yes, there was a ruling on the double jeopardy issue after the first trial, and that if you take a photo snapshot of that time, but then we move on to a second trial and they lighten the photos again. They're not color, but they're still lightened. They've still altered the photos. Why doesn't that lend support to us making a determination that that was an attempt by the prosecution to affect the, to goad you, the defendant, into asking for a mistrial?
Well, first, that evidence was obviously not before the trial court at the time that it made its ruling on the double jeopardy claim. And at the second trial, when the prosecution attempted to introduce these lightened photographs, there was no renewed objection at that point, asking the trial court to again reconsider the motion in light of this new evidence. So none of this was anything that was in front of the trial court, and this court needs to review the trial court's ruling based on the information that it had before it at the time. But again, I don't think that the prosecution's subsequent attempt to introduce lightened photographs indicates at all that the court or that the prosecution was attempting to goad the defendant into requesting a mistrial. And as the court knows, those enhanced or lightened photographs were not introduced in the second trial. And in the second trial, the defendant was acquitted of all the charges related to the photograph. So there was absolutely no prejudice to the defendant from the prosecution's attempt to introduce those photographs in the second trial. And I think if the court also looked at the cases that are cited in both of the briefs regarding the double jeopardy claims, in none of those cases did the court find a double jeopardy violation. And the facts of those cases are far more egregious than what this court is presented with here. In those cases, the issue occurred in front of the jury, and the jury was aware of the evidence that came in. And again, here, all of this occurred outside the presence of the jury. The jury was not aware of the color photographs, of the enhanced photographs, of anything of that nature. So there was certainly no motivation on the part of the prosecutor to attempt to receive a second trial and better his chances of obtaining a conviction in a new trial. If the court has no further questions on the double jeopardy claim, I'm happy to answer any questions on the remaining issues.
I guess I do. I'm not sure if Mr. Brock's going to get to this or not. On the obscenity, the challenge to the as-applied issue.
Yes.
As best as I can understand his argument, and he'll correct me if I get this totally wrong, it's that there's essentially a constitutional right to send videos or to share even explicit information in the context of a private, loving relationship. I'm just curious whether, if those were the facts, would you agree that that would be protected?
Well, first, I just want to point out in this particular case that I do not believe that this issue is properly preserved for this court. While the defendant did make this challenge in the trial court only ruled on the facial constitutionality of this statute. It did not address the defendant's argument that there was an as-applied challenge, and the defendant did not seek a ruling on that basis. So for those reasons, this claim is not properly before this court on appeal. However, obscene material is not constitutionally protected, and of course the state has a legitimate interest in preventing the dissemination of obscene material to children. It seems that the defendant's argument here is really that he did not violate the statute because within the context of his relationship with this particular victim, the video was not obscene. But whether or not the contents of the video is obscene is of course a question of fact for the jury. And the defendant was able to argue and did in fact argue that this particular videotape was not obscene due to his relationship with the victim. Of course, the jury found otherwise, and there is sufficient evidence in the record to support the jury's verdict.
So when we look at the constitutionality issue, the standard seems to be that it's whether the average person would find it obscene, correct?
Yes, based on community standards.
Do you perceive that then to be an objective standard as opposed to a personal standard employed by the parties to the communication?
Yes, Your Honor, but they can certainly take into account the particular situation and view that objectively based on the relationship between the parties and how they would view that.
So is it your position that in a situation, for example, let's assume husband and wife, and they exchange a video between them because one is located in Afghanistan, for example, on a deployment, mm-hmm. and the other is in the United States. Are you saying that those communications between husband and wife, for example, would be subject to the obscenity statute?
Now again, here what we're dealing with is the dissemination of obscene material to a minor. So of course that would be a very different situation than what we have here where the victim in this case was 15 years old and the defendant was sending videotaped messages or videotapes to the victim in this case.
But again, if they had been married, what would the situation be then? She would still be a minor, but let's assume she obtained her parents' consent to the marriage.
And again, that's not the facts of this
right.
case, of course, but I think that the jury is provided with the instructions, including the definition of obscene, as well as the definition of patently offensive. It's up to the jury to determine, based on the evidence presented, whether the conduct in this particular case falls within that statute, and in this case, the jury did.
So just to clarify, so we'd be looking at what an objectively reasonable person would consider in this particular context? Is that where you suggest the standard is?
Yes. I mean, when you look at the definition of the terms, patently offensive means so offensive on its face to affront the current community standards of tolerance. So we are looking at what the current community standards of tolerance are.
And we would consider the context in which the video was sent.
Yes,
as part of that. Okay, thank you.
If the court has no further questions, the people will request that this court affirm the defendant's convictions.
Thank you.
Thank you. I will try to cover all of that. First, with respect to double jeopardy, I want to correct something. One, these photos were taken in the privacy of the complaining witness's own room. She used her own computer. She used her own web camera. She was the one that posed, did the lighting, did everything. How the police got these is that they were then emailed. They were emailed directly to the police. They were not printed out on her computer in any way, shape, or form. They were emailed to the police, who then colored them and then used those colors and then manipulated and enhanced those color photos. So what was presented on discovery was color photos and manipulated colored photos, not black and white. Now, what we have here is that Ms. Jones has stated that we have things that are, she said, cited some case law where they are not, which is substantially more egregious. In this case, I don't agree with that. I think this case is incredibly egregious. And the main reason this case is incredibly egregious is that the prosecutor himself was present at that meeting on October 18th. He knew from the complaining witness's own mouth that she only gave him black and white prints, and yet he continued on this intentional course of trying to admit these colored photos and these manipulated color photos as what the true evidence was. Now, the argument has been made, well, you could have just copied those colored photos in black and white, but you know what? It's not for me to speculate on what the prosecution and what the people are trying to admit against my client. I'm here to defend. I'm not here to say, well, okay, maybe they can do this. And that is an unreasonable burden. They had an obligation by Rule 16 to present this Brady information to me at the very beginning, as soon as practical. And here we go, a jury's been sat on the day of trial, we're ready to bring the jury in, the judge has ruled no color photos, no manipulated color photos come in, and all of a sudden, where's the black and white photos? That's what we have. Along with his continued misconduct even at the second trial, that's why this court can find that was clearly an erroneous decision and that manifest necessity was incorrect. Now, with respect to the obscenity, the court had some very good questions on obscenity, and I think what we're talking about here is we're talking about the interplay of the First Amendment. We're talking about the interplay of the Ninth Amendment, right of privacy. What we have here, we have two people in a legally allowed relationship. They can have sex. They can have a child. They can get married. They can live together if they want. Yet the state comes down and says, well, no, wait a minute, you can't take photos, because she's under 18. And so I understand why there is a prohibition on that type of stuff, but when you look at the case law regarding the prohibition, you see that it was all made for, it goes to the purpose of what this was made for. It was made for a public consumption. It was made for resale. And that's not what we have here. We have a video that Mr. Schaefer made in the confines of his relationship, during the course of his relationship, when they were still, in essence, living together under the complaining witness's mother's own roof. And we have this video being transmitted to her. It wasn't sent to anybody else. It wasn't sent to the world. It was sent to one person. And she kept that photo. She kept that photo on her phone for over a year. She kept that photo on her phone until she decided that she really hated my client and decided that she needed to go after her. Now, this is what we have. For 8 months, that was on there.
Mr. Braddock, you're just about out of time, but I do have a question.
Yes, thank you.
Hopefully you had a chance to answer the substantive portion of the obscenity claim, but it seems to me that there's a procedural question out there too, and that is that you waived it by not raising the as-applied portion of the constitutional argument.
I don't agree with that accusation in any way, shape, or form. We filed the first motion raising the applied constitutional issues back in July of 2010. We filed a subsequent motion again in September of 2012, attacking the as applied. We filed a subsequent third motion, which was the court requested a specific response on People v. Bowles that we filed on September 30th, and we did that. The court did not issue its ruling until December 11th, right as the jury was coming in. And if you'll read that ruling, at the very end of the ruling, the court basically went out and laid out the facts as to why it was denying overbroad argument, and then at the end it basically said, hey, by the way, we're denying it on all other grounds too. Now, all I can do, I can bring it to the court's attention, which we did. We filed numerous motions and had numerous motion hearings regarding that attack, and the court they did not choose to issue detailed facts, but the issue was raised and it was on appeal.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.